Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Adam Sykes is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Silver Star recipient and former CIA paramilitary officer who now writes spy thrillers. He's also the co-author of a nonfiction book, Open Skies, My Life as Afghanistan's First Female Pilot. Adam Sykes has an MA in Global, International, and Comparative History from Georgetown University. His first spy thriller was Landslide. He now has written a second novel, The Underhanded, about rogue spies, conspiring diplomats, and business executives with secrets dating back to the 19th century. Adam Sykes, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, what is your connection with Chico?
Yes. So my uncle, Dr. Jeff Lebosky, he lives in Chico. And for some of the listeners, they may even know him. But a year ago, he invited me up to Chico because I live in Southern California and we've been enduring some heavy-duty rains recently, but today the sun is finally out. But last year, Jeff invited me up to speak to a group up there called the Poet Society. And I had an opportunity to speak with this group. We had dinner and talked about my time in the Marine Corps, my time at the Central Intelligence Agency, and then my journey to become a writer. And so that's my connection to Chico, which is just a lovely town.
Well, you gained some fans here. Some people who talked to you while you were here were quite impressed. And also, Dr. Lebosky is an author himself. In addition to being a physician, he has also written books. So I'm impressed that you are kind of continuing the family tradition.
Yeah. Well, little known, he has been reading my manuscripts from the beginning, including the first manuscript that I wrote that I started writing in 2012. I started writing it when I was in East Africa, still with the CIA, on an operation of all things. Took me a couple years to complete it, but he read it in 2013 or 2014, and he thought it was decent, but that didn't get picked up. It took a few more tries to finally get a manuscript picked up, but he's been reading my work from the beginning. I'm hugely grateful to Dr. Lebosky.
Well, now, you mentioned the CIA, and if your book is about secrets, I would think maybe you had a little hesitation that maybe you better check it out with higher-ups to make sure your book wasn't revealing things that should not be revealed.
That's true. So most authors who have prior military or intelligence experience, meaning they maybe served in the U.S. Army and Special Operations, or maybe they were in the Navy, or they were at CIA or NSA or DIA, any number of the alphabet soup agencies out there. When you are working at these organizations, you most often have access to classified information, whether it's a secret or top secret or compartmentalized level. And to get access to that, you know, you have to go through these review processes and investigations to be granted a clearance, but you also sign what's called an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. And that basically binds you for the rest of your life that you are not going to reveal any sensitive or classified information. So if you become a writer like myself, and there's many other authors out there in a similar situation, anything that I look to publish that pertains or references information or a period or event that I may have had access to has to go through the review process to make sure it doesn't contain any secrets or reveal any information that could put people in harm's way.
Yeah, so you made sure that the CIA was okay with what you wrote in your book.
For sure.
My guest is a former CIA, and he was a paramilitary officer. A former CIA paramilitary officer, and he's now writing spy thrillers. So what's the setting for your new novel, Adam?
So The Underhanded, which is the title, takes place in modern times. And it principally occurs across Europe. We'll start in the south of France. The characters find themselves in England and London for a time. They find themselves back in France, in Germany, in Strasbourg. They find themselves all over Europe, a place I've spent a number of years of my life in. And I really enjoy those international settings. And I always have since I was a little kid. I've really enjoyed these international thrillers that take you all over the world.
Well, there's a clue just on the cover of your book. You have a map of Europe with some red circles around some of these places in Europe. So that grabs the reader's attention, I think, from the very beginning. Ooh, what's taking place here in these various places in Europe? Now, another thing that is obvious and I think draws the reader into the story is that it's told in the first person. So who is this I that's telling this story?
So the protagonist is Professor William Dresden. And the story starts off where he has had a rough go of it in his academic career. He recently got thrashed by his peers and other elements of the academic community. And he's down in the dumps, so to speak. And he's trying to recover, figuring out what he's going to do next. And the basis or the background for Professor Dresden, like a lot of my characters, are inspired by real people. And so is Professor Dresden. There's some elements of his background that are of a person I knew. And that's how I built Professor Dresden.
And I think that's why these characters seem so real. This guy does seem real to us because you based him on a real person. So this college professor, William Dresden, is one of the protagonists. And then you have another protagonist. And who is she?
Adeline Parker. And she's a MI6 or British Secret Intelligence Service officer. And she, too, you know, her background, the inspiration for her character is an SIS officer that I encountered during my time at the Central Intelligence Agency. Adeline's tough. She's smart. She's had her own troubles in her own life. She's determined and she's bold. I mean, she is one of those individuals that you would encounter and you'd know right from the beginning that she's someone not to be trifled with. And she's extremely confident in what she does.
Well, let's take a look at chapter one. And this is taking place in Provence in France. And where is Professor Dresden as you start chapter one?
Yes, so Professor Dresden, at this moment in chapter one, he's sitting on the back patio of his dilapidated villa, his family's villa. And as I mentioned earlier, he's trying to recover and figure out what he's going to do next after his life's work has been torn apart by the academic community. And I'll start. I threw back the last of my wine and snatched up the phone.
Okay, so
hello?
Sorry, yeah. So his phone is vibrating and he doesn't answer it right away. But then you say, you as Professor Dresden, you say,
I threw back the last of my wine and snatched up the phone. Hello?
Hello. Am I speaking with Professor William Dresden of Princeton University?
Asked a woman's voice I didn't recognize. She had a British accent and a confident tone, like one accustomed to chucking authority around. May I ask who's calling? I replied.
My name is Adeline, and I have something urgent to chat with the professor about.
Okay, I replied, remaining polite but noting that she hadn't offered a last name.
Are you Professor Dresden?
She asked again. I am.
Good. Glad I reached you.
What can I do for you?
I'll get right to the point. Neither of us like having our time wasted.
The woman began.
My organization needs your assistance. We're aware that for the past few years, you've been researching the lives of some lesser-known men from the 19th century. You've argued that they were driving forces during Europe's imperial era, and you recently gave a talk in Washington, D.C. about them. You caused quite a bit of controversy.
I didn't respond, but she was right. My latest research had indeed caused a pompous cabal to descend from the ivory tower who were intent on ripping up my life's work. By focusing on the people that surrounded the famous personalities of the past, rather than the statesmen and generals themselves, I'd shown that the aides and deputies of history were often as influential as the principals. They worked behind the scenes, pushing here and whispering there, orchestrating events according to their own designs and those of their masters. Their obscurity was their power, and these lesser-known individuals had intrigued me for the past 20 years or so. Sadly, in recent months, more than a few scholars, people I would call my peers, had attacked my conclusions, picking apart my research methods and analysis, and even my misplaced commas. Some went so far as to call me second rate, which I will admit hurt. Wasn't all that surprising, I suppose, for those who devoted themselves to being the renowned authority on the likes of Napoleon or Roosevelt, my analysis had called into question their life's work. One historian from George Washington University even accused me of fabricating my research, although nothing could be further from the truth. That comment truly shocked me, something I'd not encountered before and never in all my years of academia heard levied in front of an audience. To say it'd been an uncomfortable time would have put it too gently. Thus, I wondered what side of the argument this woman was on and what she wanted. The prospect of thrashing out some minor point of no real consequence didn't entice me, and in my current state, if provoked, I'd likely pop off and say something I'd regret. Being kind was one of life's most important qualities, my dear mother had always said, and I agreed with her. But after a drink or two, I could become a little edgy, which might be good or bad, depending on your perspective.
From my own work,
the woman continued,
and in light of what you claim to have uncovered about these men, I have some documents I think you should see.
Is that so? May I ask what they're about?
They pertain to a small group of men of the same era and caliber that you lectured on, their actions connected.
Could you be more specific, please? I asked, now thinking the woman may not have called to put me on the rack. She had another angle, though it was still unclear. Maybe she was nuts. You said your name was Adeline, and you represent who?
I'd rather not say anything more on the phone. All I can tell you is that the papers have been secreted away for a long time. The information they contain, coupled with events in recent years, suggest we're facing a revived threat to both Europe and America.
I sat up. What? What are you talking about?
This may sound bizarre, but you must believe me. What I'm referring to is highly sensitive.
I don't understand. What information?
I shouldn't say more right now. I need you to trust me.
Trust you?
We shouldn't discuss anything else. It's too dangerous. We must meet in person.
Too dangerous? Who are you and how did you get this number? I raised out of my chair and scanned the backyard of the villa. It was sunset and the shadows were dancing underneath the Aleppo pines that dotted the hills. I felt the hair on the back of my neck stand up and, for a reason I could not explain, wondered if I was being watched.
Professor Dresden, I have no doubt you're aware that Europe is facing numerous concerning challenges, an immigration crisis, climate impact, a resurgence of ethno-nationalist movements, Russia hammering on the Eastern door. We need to meet tomorrow morning. Everything will become clear once we speak.
I didn't know how to respond. The woman wasn't making sense. It was as if she drenched me with a mass of my own personal strife, threaded with societal chaos and nonsense, intending to frighten or motivate me, I couldn't tell. All I could muster was, "Thank you for the call, Miss Adeline, but I'm going to hang up now. Have a good..."
Professor, wait. There's more. I wanted to tell you this in person, but...
She paused.
I have information about the death of your father. It was no accident.
I slowly sat back down. Her words reverberating in my ears, my chest suddenly going hollow. My father had died over 20 years ago in a car crash outside Paris. Images of a crumpled car and emergency workers scrambling about flashed through my mind. What are you talking about? What do you know about my father?
Meet me tomorrow morning at 8 at Le Trastevere in Villefranche-sur-Mer. It's on the water. Do you know it?
Yes, I said without thinking. It was a restaurant in a small coastal town east of Nice.
Good. See you then.
The line went dead. but I kept the phone to my ear and stared across the countryside at the setting sun. I lost track of time, unable to form a coherent thought. The woman, Adeline, everything she said was at once a blur, but jostled with vivid points of intense clarity, painful memories.
This is author Adam Sykes, and he was reading from his new novel, The Underhanded. And he was reading the words of his protagonist, Dr. William Dresden, and I happen to be reading Adeline Parker, who was an M6 officer. She was British. So we meet the two protagonists, and in a story like this, you've got to have villains. And when do we meet the villains in this story, Adam? Did I give the name of your book, by the way, The Underhanded? That's the name of your new novel, The Underhanded. So now, who are the villains?
Well, the villains don't come about until a few chapters later. You hear whispers of them. You maybe have a short scene with them, but they don't really get introduced for a few more pages. But they are a secret organization, the Strausberg Executive. And they date all the way back to the Franco-Prussian War, which is where their origins come from, which was in 1870.
Well, you know, when I'm reading your book, it sends me to Google for a lot of these things, like this Strasbourg thing you just mentioned, and these locations all over Europe. And you mentioned this accident of your father's, and that's a mystery. And we wonder, okay, how's all this related? And you mentioned that your father was like he had a perpetual frown on his face. And so he's a character that we don't really know anything about. And so this is one of the mysteries that's going on. And that you fill us in, more or less, up until this chapter 7. And where are we in chapter 7?
So in chapter 7, we're now in Germany and we're in Dusseldorf.
And is Professor Dresden in this chapter?
He's not, but this is where you're going to meet three critical members of the story that are going to be with you through most of it. I have a short reading I can do of them.
Yeah. Would you read us from chapter 7?
Yes. So chapter 7, Dusseldorf, Germany. The corporate jet took an hour to fly from Frankfurt to Dusseldorf. Sophia was met by her driver on the tarmac, and they headed north, away from the city in a fully armored Mercedes-Maybach S600 guard sedan. She sat in the back reading a report her firm had drafted. It contained the financials of the new Flemish Alliance in Belgium, the National Front in France, and the Freedom Party of Austria. Her firm had produced this report independently. No one had contracted them to do it. But the document contained information Sophia was keen to examine, a report on the viability of Europe's three most powerful right-wing political parties. She needed to know how far they could go with their current resources and what it would take to push them even further. "We'll arrive within the hour," said the driver, looking in the rearview mirror at Sophia's bowed head. Sometime later, the car turned onto a massive estate and approached the manor house. The Mercedes stopped in front of the main steps. A man in a crisp gray suit with close-cropped dark hair and eyes the color of glacial ice opened the door. "He's in the study," he said, his voice matching the hardness of his features. "Good evening to you too, Faust," replied Sophia. "You'll need to make it quick. He has other matters to attend to tonight." "I'll take as much time as needed." Sophia made her way into the house, down the grand hall, and walked through the double doors of the study. She stopped just inside and looked at the elderly gentleman sitting behind the desk. He had salt and pepper hair, and his skin was weathered, tanned and wrinkled. He wore a charcoal suit with a blue shirt, accented by a white collar and French cuffs. He was using a gold-plated fountain pen to sign a series of documents. Without looking up, the gentleman motioned for her to take a seat in one of the two chairs in front of his desk. Faust moved to the back corner of the room and stood, directing his eyes at nothing, yet aware of everything. "Tell me what happened," said the man. Herr Kanzler, thank you for receiving me at such an hour. And Herr Kanzler is the German word for chancellor. The old man waved his hand. I always have time for you, my dear. Now what is it? Sophia explained that the attempt on Professor William Dresden and MI6 agent Adeline Parker's lives had failed. They'd escaped, their current whereabouts unknown. The Kanzler leaned back and steepled his fingers. This is troubling. I don't remember agreeing to such extreme measures. She didn't respond. The Kanzler hadn't authorized the bombing, but she hadn't sought his permission either. She believed killing Dresden and Parker would make the problem go away. If the old man didn't like it, that was his problem. I wanted the professor out of the way, but this... The Kanzler's voice drifted off. I will fix this, Herr Kanzler. I trusted you when you told me this would be quick and painless, with no loose ends. It will be, but it isn't. I will handle it. I think that time has passed. The Kanzler raised his gaze toward the ceiling as if looking to the heavens for the answer. I'll assume control from here. Sophia clenched her jaw, but immediately regretted allowing such a response. You disagree? Asked the Kanzler, searching her face. He could read her well, and she knew it. It was infuriating. She was masterful at manipulating those around her like trained pets sitting at her feet. But not him. She had no such confidence in his presence. She felt like a child being toyed with, plagued by the emotions of a toddler, and unable to restrain herself. So she said, I'd never oppose your wishes.
This is spy thriller author Adam Sykes, and he's reading from his novel, The Underhanded. And he has written two previous books, a fiction and a nonfiction, co-authored a nonfiction book. And this new novel, The Underhanded, he has just introduced us to the villains, the two principal villains in his story. Now, in the case of mystery spy thrillers, we don't want to spoil the suspense for the reader, but what else can you tell us, Adam, without spoiling the suspense in your novel?
Yeah. Well, maybe take a moment to talk about where this story came from.
Yeah.
So I started writing this particular story in 2016. But the inspiration goes back to the mid-90s. So when I was in the Marine Corps, I served in the Balkans and got to see some of the tragedy and horrors that were a part of the Bosnian conflict and the things that were going on there. And in fact, the inspiration for the protagonist, William Dresden, who was a professor and a real person who I studied under, he worked in orphanages during the Balkan War. And when I met him years later, we would talk about, you know, our experiences over there and what we saw. And that's something that always stuck with me. And I've been a student of history of all my life, so I have enjoyed studying these things. Well, a few years later, I'm now with the CIA. And when I say a few years, we're probably talking 20 years. And I was involved in an operation in Central Europe and parts of Northern Europe. And I can't go into any details about it. But what I will say is that during that time, I encountered and became aware of some of the extremist groups that are still active in Europe. And then if you couple that with my interest in history, like I said, I'm an academically trained historian. I enjoyed seeing the connections of people and events over time and recognizing that the events that are happening today typically have been set in motion years, sometimes decades, sometimes centuries before. So if you take those three elements, that's where the inspiration for The Underhanded came from. You have a cast of characters with different backgrounds and experiences, and then you have these historical components, these historical conspiracies. And, you know, I love the works of James Rollins and Brad Meltzer and Dan Brown and Steve Barry. I mean, these are the authors that I have devoured throughout my life. And so I wanted to create something similar.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because history fascinates me, and the more I study it, the more I realize the truth of what you just said, that these things that go back for sometimes centuries, that we are kind of oblivious to. So you mentioned that your MA is in Global, International, and Comparative History from Georgetown University, and I'm guessing this professor was, you studied with him at Georgetown, correct?
He was. I took one class with him, and he and I became friends. We're still friends to this day, which is wonderful. But I had a great time at Georgetown. Georgetown is a wonderful school, and if things have been different, I might have found myself on the way to becoming a professor, but, you know, my life took a different turn. But I thoroughly enjoyed my time there on the hilltop.
Well, is there anything else you'd like us to know, again, without spoiling the suspense for us, of your new novel, The Underhanded?
I think one thing that I try to do with my fiction and my novels is not to create the superhuman character. You know, there's some great heroes out there, great books. I love them. I read them as much as I read anything else. And I'm a very diverse reader. I read everything from Hemingway to the spy thrillers to Ian Fleming to romance to Amor Towles. You know, I'm across the board, as well as a diverse collection of nonfiction. But given my experiences in the Marine Corps as a combat veteran, and then my experiences in the Central Intelligence Agency as a paramilitary officer doing covert action, I wanted to create characters that have flaws, that don't do everything right all the time, and that make mistakes and then have to overcome them. I would say that people who have experienced high stress situations, they know that their bodies act, you know, in physical ways. They know that they have to make decisions under pressure without all the information. And sometimes you're making a decision that's the least worst option. Or sometimes you make the wrong decision based on the available information, thinking it was the best. Or sometimes you just make a mistake. And so how do you overcome that? How do you keep going? Because that's what people face in real life. I've had the pleasure of working with some amazing individuals, whether in the Marine Corps or in the intelligence world. And I think the ability to overcome adversity, to bounce back, to get back up if you've been knocked down, is critical to how we go forward in life.
Yeah, and that's what makes these characters so real for us as readers. And little details, I enjoy the details you include. For example, Adeline Parker's British, and she drinks Yorkshire tea. And I notice little things like that because I've spent a good bit of time in some of these countries that you, in parts of Europe that you mentioned. So I really enjoyed this book, and I'm sure your readers will too. I mean, I think so. So thank you for writing this and for giving us a little background information about this new novel of yours, Adam.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it resonated with you. I know we've had some other conversations, and it's fascinating to hear about your world travels as well and how we may have intersected over the years.
My guest has been Adam Sykes. His new novel is The Underhanded. When we come back, we'll hear from my next guest, Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is host of NPR's Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, who has written a book about how John C. Fremont and his wife Jessie helped cause the Civil War. The book that you wrote, Imperfect Union, How Jessie and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War, was such a fascinating book for me. I had a personal connection to a lot of what you had to say, but there was so much I had never known. So how did you get interested in this topic?
I'd read about them ever since I was a kid because I read books about the Old West and books about the Civil War, and they appear in those books again and again and again. But they're not often treated very deeply. They're minor characters described as very famous, very ambitious, even very vain, making a lot of mistakes along the way. And so you learn bits about them, but I didn't know them deeply until much more recently. In recent years, I've been writing about the westward expansion of the United States. I wrote this book called Jackson Land, about Andrew Jackson, the president, and a Cherokee leader, John Ross, and their battle for more than 20 years over expelling Cherokees from their land in the eastern United States and moving them west of the Mississippi. That was an early phase of America's westward expansion. And when that project was done, I wanted to explore what happened next, the capture of the West and the Pacific Coast. And John and Jesse Fremont, both of them, were central figures in that story. John was a Western explorer who went out and mapped the Oregon Trail and went to Mexican-controlled California and even helped take it over. As an explorer, he did not discover that much that was so new. But he did go back to Washington, where he was based, and write best-selling accounts of his adventures. And in a sense, that, along with the maps, was the point. His mission was to publicize the West, to entice people to move along the Oregon Trail and settle the Oregon country near the Pacific coast, because that was the way the United States would take that land over, was through settlement. That was the point, and he, with Jesse's help, was a brilliant publicist, it turned out. They collectively were good publicists, and while making the West more famous, they also made themselves very famous.
Well, now, you mentioned Jesse just now, and when I first encountered Jesse and John Fremont, I thought, oh, John had a brother named Jesse.
Ah.
And then I discover, no, this is a woman, his wife. How did she get the name Jesse?
It's fascinating. She was the daughter of a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, who had a daughter and then expected the next child to be a son and appeared to be all ready to name the son after his father, Jesse. Turned out to be a daughter instead, but he was a stubborn guy, so he changed the spelling slightly, J-E-S-S-I-E, and went with that name. So he effectively gave her a boy's name, or what sounded like a boy's name. And Jesse wrote in a memoir many years later, "My father gave me early the place a son would have had. In the absence of a son, he didn't have one until later, he took her along hunting with him. She was devoted to him, and she would carry the game bag in which there might be a dead bird that he had just shot. And she would trail along after him in Washington when he went to work at the Senate, and he would leave her at the Library of Congress for safekeeping. And she would even trail along with him to meet presidents, starting with President Andrew Jackson. She grew up, in a sense, as a boy would, doing things that boys were supposed to be doing. And she wanted to do more of that. She wanted to be involved in politics. She wanted to be involved in her father's work of encouraging the settlement of the West. She wasn't allowed to because she was the wrong gender for the time. But she ultimately found a way to be her father's assistant and also to work with her father through her husband, who assisted her father's work through his explorations.
Well, I want to repeat her father's name as a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, because that name was very familiar, but I didn't know that the Thomas Hart Benton that we all know as a painter was a descendant of Jesse Fremont's father.
That's absolutely correct. They had the same name, and the painter is probably a little more famous today. But in the 1840s and 50s, and a little bit before that, Thomas Hart Benton, the senator, was a giant figure. He was one of Missouri's first two senators when it became a state in 1821, and he spent 30 years in the United States Senate. He was among the founders of the Democratic Party. He was a political giant with an opinion on every topic. He had an ability to give speeches for hours. hours and hours and hours. He had taught himself multiple languages. He was very erudite. He was also in many ways an awful person who owned slaves, just to give one example, and who killed a man in a duel once. In many ways, an appalling individual, and yet also a very talented lawmaker and senator who passed on a lot of his knowledge to his daughter.
Well, we know a good bit about Jesse's father, but what do we know about John Fremont's father?
Very little, except that he was a French immigrant. John Charles Fremont's father, who had a slightly different spelling to his name, by the way, fell in love with a Virginia aristocrat, and even though she was unable to get a divorce, they ran away together to Savannah, Georgia, where John was born. They then moved around the South, and the father died when John was very young, about 5 years old. And from that time on, the family was relatively poor. The mother had some of her inheritance she was able to claim, but they were a little short of money and living in Charleston, South Carolina. And so he began life as this penniless young man doing various things and trying to find his way in the world. He ultimately worked his way into the United States Army. He got a lieutenant's commission. He was part of something called the Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, which was supposed to map the West, among other places. And that was his early work, which was not work that would bring him great distinction necessarily, except for the fact that he met and eloped with this senator's daughter, who gave him access to the political connections and the media connections that were necessary to become a celebrity.
Well, you mentioned his born in Savannah and living in Charleston, and I was excited that he went to the College of Charleston because I spent a year teaching there.
Oh, okay.
So I have a personal connection to a lot of these places. I lived in the mountains where the Cherokees lived, and It was called Enota, the Enchanted Valley. That's what it meant in Cherokee. So a lot of this book was just touched me personally. But now, so that people, I mentioned that he went to the College of Charleston. He was not an ignoramus. He was a very smart guy, and I was impressed that he knew Greek, because when he saw the Golden Gate here in California, he thought of a Greek word.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. He's the guy who gave the name Golden Gate to the mouth of San Francisco Bay, and it was a play off of the Golden Horn, which was the name of a bit of a waterway, a trading port for the ancient city of Constantinople, now Istanbul, Constantinople and Istanbul, all the same city. That was the city where the ancient Romans conducted their trade with Asia, and that's why he called it the Golden Gate. I always thought that Golden Gate meant that San Francisco Bay was the golden entryway to California, but I was looking in the wrong direction. Fremont was looking outward. It was a golden portal outward to the Pacific and to Asia, and an opportunity for the United States to have its own direct trading routes with India and with China. He was playing off of the vision of Senator Benton, who had wanted this kind of a trading port in the Pacific for a long time. And he was looking forward in many ways to the world we have today, where the most important economic relationship, single relationship, probably is across the Pacific from America to China.
Well, you know, I'm amused that you said that, because that's precisely my own idea. I didn't realize it was that the Golden Gate was the entry into the harbor, and he was looking the other direction to Asia. It seems like that everything I read about him, John Fremont had impeccable timing. And typically he's known, I think, as the leading explorer of the 19th century. But all these other things, he was on the scene of so much that was going on in the United States, this new country.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And it's one of the reasons that he appears in surely thousands and thousands of history books, just never, or rarely, I should say, explored in great depth. There are only a relative few biographies about him over the last 150 or 160 years that have been written. But he's in thousands of books because he was involved in so much. He was involved in westward expansion. He was involved in the United States war with Mexico, which was part of that expansion. Involved in the Oregon Trail and the acquisition of Oregon by the United States. Involved in the creation of the Republican Party in the years before the Civil War. That gave him a role in causing the Civil War, bringing it about, because the Republican Party's creation was something that was seen as profoundly threatening to the South and is ultimately the reason the South left the Union and fired the first shot of the Civil War. He was then involved in the Civil War as a general, and he was fired by Abraham Lincoln, later challenged Lincoln for the presidency briefly in 1864, and even after the war, he was involved in transcontinental railroads. It was an epic life that he lived in large measure because he had Jesse Benton Fremont to fill in some of his shortcomings or inadequacies and to help him publicize himself and defend himself politically and do things that needed to be done. She was a huge part of the story, too.
Well, the very cover of the title of your book, the last few words, that Jesse and John Fremont helped cause the Civil War, that was intriguing to me.
Yeah, it is amazing. But it's just right there. It's in the creation of the Republican Party. There was this dramatic change going on in the United States at the time. It was a change in demographics. The North and South were divided over slavery. Northern states had gradually abolished slavery. Southern states ever more firmly embraced it. And any national political party tried to stay quiet on slavery for many, many years. They didn't want to offend anybody. They needed Southern votes in order to assemble an electoral majority, which meant they couldn't say anything against slavery even if they wanted to. Well, but then that changed. That changed because there was a change in population. The North grew in population much more rapidly, which gave them more power. And suddenly there was this party, the Republican Party in the North, that had a chance to win the presidency with Northern votes alone, which was very destabilizing.
Well, I was intrigued by that, too, because I hear a lot of reasons for the Civil War, but this shed new light on it. And I found that fascinating, Steve.
Well, I appreciate that, and I especially appreciate it because it relates to today, when we're also going through demographic changes that can be seen as profoundly destabilizing. And it's one of the underlying realities of our politics. When you ask about why our politics are so bitter, it's because you do have people who fear not just losing an election, but losing for all time. President Trump told his supporters in 2016, "This is your last chance to win," because of the demographic changes in the country, which he was going to stop. That's a thing that he explicitly said. Now we also have Democrats and more progressive people who fear being shut out of power forever because of the way the president is appointing conservative justices to lifetime appointments, and also treating the presidency in a certain way and seen as trampling many rules or seen as authoritarian. This is the underlying cause, I think, of a lot of the tension and the bitterness of our politics. People feel the stakes are very, very, very high.
Well, I want to thank you for writing this book, Steve. I found it so fascinating. I may not be your typical reader because of my own personal connections with this, but thank you for writing this book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War.
Oh, I'm glad to have done it. Thanks for the invitation.
After a break, we'll hear commentary by Richard Parker on the Civil War. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And now commentator Richard Parker shares thoughts on the Civil War, or the war between the states.
Robert E. Lee surrendered his sword at Appomattox on the 9th of April, 1869. This is believed to be a historical fact by many and a piece of typical Yankee-inspired fiction by others. These latter reside almost exclusively south of the Mason-Dixon line, of course, where I grew up and where my brother still lives. Not only do these Southern non-believers not believe that the Union Army won the war, many of them don't believe that the war is over. There's been a truce of sorts, sure, but there are Southern boys who are sure that the Articles of Surrender were a clever ploy by General Lee to distract the Union officer corps while he urged his soldiers to slink out of Virginia while the slinking was good. Now, of course, my brother, a moderately educated person, doesn't believe all that, but you wouldn't know it from watching him for a while. He's a charter member of the 33 and a third Arkansas Irregulars, and he's fully equipped for the role. He has a complete Confederate uniform, sewed up by our late sainted mother, and complete with a gray kepi-style cap he made himself. He fires a muzzle-loader rifle that fires a 50-caliber round ball with amazing accuracy. In fact, he was the state muzzleloader champion a couple of decades ago. He also built a small-scale Civil War-era cannon that fires a 1-inch lead ball nearly a mile. Now, Brother Michael is mainly in it for the amusement, I'm pretty sure, but he's serious about his amusement. While we're at it, let me be serious for just a minute. When I was in high school in Hot Springs, Arkansas, I played in the band. At football games, there was a tune we played at every game that made the fans nuts. It was called South. And the first part of it was a call and response that involved a cheer for the team. But then, after a drum cadence, we broke into a spirited version of Dixie, and the whole stadium stood up and went mildly crazy. It was still like that in that part of the world even well into the 60s. Memories of my younger years in the 1950s include images from the local JCPenney's store, where there were two water fountains side by side and two men's and two women's restrooms. You know the reason for this ridiculous duplication. It dates from the years of Reconstruction, during which time the North really did give the South something to be resentful about, and the hundred years of Jim Crow laws that followed that. Many of those laws were in effect until the 1960s, including the ones that justified all that extra plumbing at the Penney's store. Well, racial matters were not the only things at stake during the Civil War. There were and are Southerners today who claim that slavery was not really the issue. The issue was states' rights. But, and however, the main right the Southern states wanted to hold on to was the right to own slaves. So it goes around and then it comes around. Racism these days is different. African Americans are discouraged from voting not because of their race so much, but because of the way they might vote. I'm not so sure that this is progress. Well, good grief, I was serious for more than a minute. That may be some kind of record, and it hardly hurt at all. I'll try it again soon. Meantime, this is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Richard. I would also like to thank my first guest, spy thriller author Adam Sykes, whose latest book is The Underhanded, and also Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep, whose book is Imperfect Union. Next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Travel, alchemy for the soul. Travel has a way of molding, melting, twisting, and shaping our souls. When we least expect it, and despite our feeble attempts at keeping life predictable or seemingly safe, we are thrust into new, uncontrolled situations. If we are open to them, there is a purification that can arise, allowing our inner light to shine. However, if we first learn to trust, not just any kind of trust, but the trust that comes right after experiencing something that you might thought have killed you, and instead of retreating, you push on and take more steps into the scary unknown. Travel has always been alchemy for my soul, allowing growth and connectivity in ways that could not have happened had I stayed in the comforts of my original home. Quote, "You're just a Chico baby and will never leave this town," end quote. Powerful words directed at me when I was a small child by a well-intending grandfather. However, the damage was done, the challenge accepted, and in my attempts to prove him wrong, I began my quest. Traveling to over 36 countries, I felt inspired and alive on a deeper level than I thought possible. With the intention to visit more, my book is about a recent journey. The first method to alchemize your life is to begin to let go of fear and step into trust. Trust that the universe is showing you a path to your greater good, whether you can see the benefit or not at the time. I would often ask myself if what I'm afraid of is really a threat, or is it just a natural reaction to something unknown? A check-in provides a quick assessment to see if there is any harm on my horizon, or am I reacting from the primitive part of my brain that wants to flee at the slightest uncomfortable situation? If that were the case, I would run away from any new encounter. Lisa Carson.
The Engineer. He did indeed create heaven and earth and all. But hey, it turned out so complicated. He must never dare tweak anything ever again. The slightest interference one place, sure to mess up something somewhere else. This is why, though God is good, there is evil in the world. I'm Mike McMillan.
You. Peach fuzz and hair like straw, that I imagine the birds finding in spring to build their nests. There among the roses and twigs, where we would fish for leaves and sneak out the back gate into the neighborhood behind our house. You watch the big boys and breathe in like the ocean swell, getting ready to make your big moves. Sometimes I hold you so tight to take in the small sweetness of you, amazed at how you don't even seem to notice. So I stop and watch for your eyes. We stare like that, empty, two seashells with silent sips of sand and seawater passing between us, until suddenly, the pearl. Molly Paul.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.